Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Adam Macho. Adam Macho is the author of $6 an Hour, Confessions of a Gemini Writer, the first prize winner in Nerve Cowboy's 2011 chapbook competition. A Johnstown native, Adam is an obituary writer who tries to write about life when he can. His poems and stories have appeared in literary magazines, online journals, and the newspaper. He is also a regular columnist for the New Yinzer, Pittsburgh's finest online magazine. Hi, Adam. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. I've read your book, $6 an Hour, Confessions of a Gemini Writer, and I think it's a really great title and looking forward to hearing it.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Fast Food Affair. Once I fell for this trick, a bartering system between a petty pot dealer and myself, a sandwich artist. He'd trade me a joint for a foot-long sub, and I'd pretend to work the cash register for the camera. The weed was good, so was the food. I'd lavish it with banana peppers and the thickest tomato slices. I'd layer the lunch meat between American, cheddar, and provolone cheese. I'd spread shredded lettuce straight from the bag and sprinkle crab meat crumbs into the hand-squeezed streaks of mayo. One day, the joint was thinner, the next, anemic, so the sandwiches grew less decadent, the bread a bit harder. I'd settle for onion ends, the brown green peppers. Once, I even stomped a slice of roast beef and served it up, the tread of my boot as visible as fine print on an affidavit. It all ended when he anteed a joint made entirely of seeds. I felt it took effort to burn me like that, and saw humor and sadness in the infidelities of our fast food affair. When I told him we were through, he understood, took it better than most women I've lost, who had also used me for nothing more than a free footlong. This is "My Boss Used to Write." He would leave post-it notes all over the place, yellow flags half-mast on the bathroom door reminding us to flush, above the paperwork binders when we had to white out mathematical errors, on the whiteout when it was used excessively. I found a blue flap on my name tag once, telling me don't forget to wear my name tag. These mean and colorful passive-aggressive reminders slaying the spirit of the workplace in hot pink threats and turquoise reprimands. Post it when the dollars didn't face the same direction, when somebody left the refrigerator open at night so the back room smelled like rancid cabbage. And everyone who read the notes knew you messed up. If you restacked the magazine rack without separating and alphabetizing each issue, you'd find several sticky notes, each one a different color, suggesting you follow the pattern and stock them right next time. It was always such a shock to see them, their pointed language, penmanship like daggers, no regard for grammar or punctuation, written by a guy who was so nice when it was just you and him. Workplace Post-it Note number 36. Joseph. The trash pile's exploding. Styrofoam peanuts, addictive bubble wrap, and the microwavable chow mein dyslexic Lydia never finished. It's loaded on the garbage cart like toy bundles for charity children. The dumpster always accepts donations. How to take out the trash. Fill the garbage cart until it's bloated and unmanageable. Some will spill, but it's important to only make one trip. Be aware, mice have been found in these bags before. Roll the cart slowly. You are getting paid. Stop and collect the garbage that falls from the sides of the overloaded cart. Outside, look around. You may not get to see outside again. Slam the cart into the dumpster. Stare at the sky. Light up. Lean against the wall. Watch people and clouds, pass time, make money, do something with the garbage. When the boss demands answers, and he will want answers, what took so long, why your eyes are so red and glassy. Explain how the garbage kept spilling from the sides of that cheap cart.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Adam Macho. And he's reading from his book, $6 an Hour, Confessions of a Gemini Writer. I wanted to ask you about a sense of the real that's in your work. I mean, it really does have that feeling of recognition of real life. So I'm wondering if you find your poems watching people, or if you find your poems on the street, or how do you get to them?
Well, a lot of it is based on experience. I worked in a gas station for a long time, and some of it's just knowing people working there, or the people who come in and the stories they tell, talking to regulars. So it certainly is based in reality. I think people stand around and tell these kind of stories, and sometimes when people read these poems, they say, it sounds like a friend's just telling me a story that happened, and I think that's what I strive for.
Yeah. Well, it's working. But I've read poems that feel real, and yet they don't get complicated, and I like some of the surprises in your poems. There's a sense of humor also moving around, so I never know which way the poem's going to go, which I kind of like. Is that something that you're trying to do, or is that something that comes in revision? How does that happen?
It seems to come out that way. It seems like a shift at work, and everything during those jobs when it's dealing with the public, they come in waves, and sometimes it's really crazy, and sometimes there's a dull moment and you can look over at your coworker and laugh about something that happened 20 minutes ago. And so that's all bundled in an 8-hour shift at a gas station. So that kind of made its way in there as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good way to talk about it, coming in waves, because I can feel the waves in your poetry, you know, things moving along and then shifting and then moving. And I think we need more poems about work, though. I really do.
I agree. Work is one of those things that everybody's done it. Most people have done it, and you can relate to it. Most people have had these kind of jobs to begin with, and they look back on them and fondly, and they think about all the terrible things that happen and the poor pay and the extra labor they put in.
Not fondly, and a lot of people still have tough jobs, definitely.
Very true.
Yeah. Okay, can you read some more?
Sure. This is one that was written in somebody else's voice who helped. He was the guy you had to go to if you were working an overnight shift, and only the guys could work overnight, so he was a guy's guy, I guess. And it's called Training for the Overnight Shift, Ron's Monologue. Make sure the coffee is fresh. That's the most important thing. You will get bawled out and spit at by some of these people if you don't keep the coffee on. And when nobody's in the store, and trust me, kid, there will be times when it's just you and talk radio, and sometimes it gets so lonely you want to burn yourself just to do something. Clean the cooler doors, wipe them down with a warm, wet rag, and keep the sneeze guard free of fingerprints. Give the floor a once-over with the mop after sunup. And don't forget, cops eat free. If you want to look at the girly books, slit the plastic bag along the bottom so you can slide it back in when you're done. And don't go pulling your pud when you see those naked girls, kid. Show some moderation. Just listen to me. Do what I say and you'll be okay. You can smoke in the back room, but flick the butts outside. Try and hit Chuck, who sleeps between the dumpster and the ice machine. He may wake up and curse, but don't worry, he's harmless. You seem smart enough, kid. Now do me a favor and go pull that book from the shelf, the one with the black chick and the cheerleader outfit. And while you're at it, make sure that coffee is hot enough. There's only 2 more hours until the Sunday morning rush hits us. This is workplace post-it note number 17. Dyslexic Lydia, do not leave the toilet paper roll empty ever again. And when you hang the new one, please don't do so in an underhanded fashion. Even with your learning disability, you wipe your ass just like everyone else. Romance on the clock. The lighter fluid was lukewarm on the back of my hand, filled the love line of my palm, and slipped like liquid lust to the tile floor. Lydia watched me do this, didn't even flinch as the lighter flicked before the blue flame held steady and I caught fire for 2 full seconds. I wildly waved my hand and tried to heal myself by fitting my fist in my mouth. She took my wrist, looked the burn over like thrift store sneakers, and left it hanging limp. Really, she said, you didn't have to go and do a thing like that. This is called Why I Deserve a Raise. I'd just like to say, I've done nothing but work hard since the day I got here. Typed a resume that was never even read and wore my only tie to the interview. Polished shoes reserved for Christmas Day, funerals, and family reunions. I fake smiled and shook hands with 2 new supervisors, 3 team leaders, 10 coworkers, and 1 district manager. I showed for every shift, on weekends and holidays, both federal and religious. Worked days I requested off more than a month in advance. I punched in hungover, fever-struck, dead tired, still drunk from the night before, the same clothes as the night before, even slept in the manager's office when it wasn't worth going home. I flew through speed traps, 4-way stops, blinking yellow lights, and one time I tried to outrun an unmarked cop car, which cost me 3 days' pay, all on account of making it here. I drove through snowstorms and monsoons, rode behind grandmas going 10 miles an hour, and even weaved through the path of a 4th of July parade, my patriotism trumped only by my work ethic. I responded every time the phone rang, whether I was on call, called in, or when coworkers called off. Even left my girlfriend's phone number so the store could reach me when I wasn't home, which didn't work out so well for me, but got my boss action one night. On duty, I put in tough hours, swept and mopped every floor, been on my hands and knees with a toothbrush cleaning grout on the tile floor, broke down 15 pounds of cardboard boxes, separated the glass from plastic from aluminum cans, and handpicked through every trash bin to make sure I got them all. I bleached the bathrooms of both sexes, picked up paper stuck to the walls by adhesives unknown to me, wiped down both sides of the toilet seat, handled the bloody trash in the ladies' room, and once accidentally cleaned the crappers the day Big Joe ate 3 spicy burritos. I don't even know how he managed to hit the ceiling, but I cleaned that too. I'm even sitting here now thinking of ways I can work harder for the upcoming quarterly evaluation. So when you do hand out those 20-cent raises, I think you should consider me, because man, I could use it.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Adam Macho. And he's reading from his chapbook, $6 an Hour, Confessions of a Gemini Writer. You know, one thing I really like about your work is that interaction between the voice in the poems and all those details, lots of details, concrete details. But I like one line I was really liked was from the monologue poem, want to burn yourself just to do something. Is that it? Want to burn yourself just to do something. Something like that.
Yes.
Just cut my eye, but I think... You know, we get a lot of details, and then we have these great statements, and it keeps waking us up and, you know, redirecting us in a good way. So I don't know what my question is here, but I just, you know, want to notice that. And I want to ask you if your work as an obituary writer has affected your poetry at all.
I think so. It certainly gives you a very real motivator every day. So when you spend 8 hours a day writing death notices and you notice, you know, any age, any person, everybody dies, you know, and every day there's the obituary sections filled. So it certainly makes you want to accomplish things, provides that extra spark to accomplish something and maybe get yourself another line in your own obituary.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you written any poems about dying? I mean, about as it sort of some of the feelings come into your work at all?
Yes, more so recently. A lot of times I feel like I have to be removed from something to properly write about it, but it's certainly, I think a lot of poets end up writing about death in one way or another.
Sure.
And with me enjoying workplace poetry so much, I've kind of incorporated that and I've been working on that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there are details from people's lives that you pick up and you read that this guy spent 25 years playing in a Salvation Army band, and that's a very lucid, great detail, and things like that. It makes me refine my own details, I think.
Yeah, it seems like it would really have some effects, you know, whether you even would know what that is.
Well, it's true, and there's a strange set of sense of humor that goes along with death. Funeral directors have the strangest sense of humor, and I find myself laughing on the phone with a lot of them sometime, and then they'll get back to, okay, well, I have to go finish embalming this person now.
Yeah.
And so that balance is still there, even more so between laughter and sadness and life and death.
Yeah, seems like some really good ideas for poems in there. Definitely, you know. I also wanted to ask you about the sound in your poems, because you have some great stuff. For example, Dyslexic Lydia. Sorry to say. Dyslexic Lydia. And in a couple lines, you had Feverstruck, Dead Drunk, a lot of half rhymes going on. And I'm wondering how important sound is to you as a poet.
It's important. For about 5 years, I was working with somebody, a couple people that we graduated from college with, and we were doing a reading series in Greensburg. And once a month, everybody would bring their best stuff and read it, and things like acoustics come into play, the internal rhyme and sound. People notice that when you read it, and it adds another dimension to it. And so a lot of these were given their first test run in front of a bunch of people sitting in a coffee shop, amped up on caffeine, wanting to hear something.
Okay, can you read some more?
Sure. This is Workplace Post-it Note number 51. Gina, we are all so happy Jesus is your friend, but he's not here keeping the display window full and the bathroom floors clean, or covering for your call-offs last week. So please, stop setting the toothpicks in the shape of small crosses, unless you want to be fired for everybody else's sins. How to drink rum at work. Fill your flask for a 5-hour shift. Anything more, you'll need the bottle. Steal a few 20-ounce Cokes. Dump half, replace with rum. Steal breath mints. If customers or coworkers talk to you, ask them about themselves. They can talk, you can drink. Take out the trash, where it's cool to puke into the compactor if you have to. If they discover you are drunk, tell them they are clever and offer them a drink. This is Workplace Post-it Note number 16. Adam, I know you were drinking last night. The whole store smells like the French Quarter, and I've found 3, make that 4 empty bottles of Coke around the store. Nobody drinks that much soda. When we find someone who will work your weekend swing shifts and overnights, you are done.
That's great. You know, I think it reminds me of similar situations, you know, and jobs, and I'm sure that it does for other readers too and listeners. So it's kind of a great connector for people. Have you had that experience when you read your work out, people coming up to you and telling you stories? And
yeah, that happens. People tend, you know, they feel like they can confess any bad things or anything that they've justified at work. It's really easy to justify certain things when you think, you know, the big boss who makes more in one day than you do all year is, you know, screwing you over. It's very easy to do things a normal person would wag their finger at. But people do hear these and they come up and they say, oh, I had this terrible job, or at my job, you know, I haven't had a raise in 2 years. And so when I get hungry, I make myself a sandwich. You know?
Mm-hmm. How motivated are you by class issues in your writing? I mean, it seems to be all through there, but I mean, how consciously motivated are you by that?
I'm aware of it. Like you said at the beginning, I'm from Johnstown, and I certainly noticed from a young age that Johnstown is built on a hill, and I lived kind of near the bottom of that hill. And as you get further up into Westmont and some of those places, the houses get bigger and everybody has a lawn, and it's like they're awaiting another flood to come and just wipe out anyone on the bottom. And that's certainly something, you know, working in a gas station, you deal with people from all walks of life, and you have to have respect, or at least, you know, try and do your best to help who you can.
Have you written about that? I mean, what you were just talking about sounds really important. The hill and who lives where, and
that's coming, and okay. Something's there's something in the works about that. Yeah, but yeah. I wanted to use it out here today. So
yeah. Okay.
This is called Sweeping at 5:30 a.m., Gas Station Still Life. The bleach on the sandwich bar glistens like black ice on back roads, and the smell of thawing bread blankets the smoke seeping from the freezer into the candy bar aisle and automotive corner. The radio plays a song I didn't know, so I make up my own, a song about sweeping some sawdust tavern. My broom bristles brush dust from one corner to another as the sun turns this town golden, working alchemy in the streets and schoolyards, in the bedrooms of mill workers and white-collar commuters, through these storefront windows, illuminating me and the broom and everything in this corner store like something holy, a patron saint of the proletariat, working minor miracles for minimum wage. The miracle of hot coffee, the miracle of egg and ham on bagels, the miracle of the morning paper, the miracle of the lottery payout, the miracle of punching out at 6 a.m. This first light shines on me, cleaning bread dough from the floor. The boss arrives for the day shift, nods at me, genuflect, in my speck of light, my time card a golden ticket tucked tight into my back pocket as the clock hits 6.
Nice poem.
Thanks.
I like that one.
This is called Fish on Friday. The car started right up this morning. I didn't have to shimmy the key or wait for esoteric electric clicks to let me know the fuel pump has kicked on. You went to work at the family practice and didn't yell at or argue with or murder the woman who claims every patient has hepatitis of some letter. I didn't have to buy lunch because it was Regis's last day. He's retiring at 65 and wouldn't even eat the greasy farewell pizza. I spent the extra money on a cheap bottle of wine in a fish-shaped glass. The cat we thought would be dead last week is still puking hairballs the size of potatoes on the living room rug. I also got rejected from some fancy lit mag, the kind that pays by the line. They scribbled something encouraging in the lower left about other poems and other times. But I think about our fish bottle wine and the twist-off top in our decorative goblets above the kitchen nook. We have a drink without toasting bad jobs and bad luck, because tonight we know there are things to celebrate. Meeting with loss prevention. What's the worst thing you've ever done at work, Adam? I say I don't know. I do drink one 32-ounce Mountain Dew from the soda fountain at the beginning of every shift. He says, you know we have cameras, right? I shake my head. I know I would have been fired long ago if this were true. I'd taken snack cakes and beef jerky and rolling papers and cigarettes and magazines and road maps and money right from the register. I gave free food to friends and fresh cookies to strangers. I played scratch and win lottery tickets for several hours until I broke even. I say, that's really all I can think of. Loss prevention scribbles red in a notebook, rolls his cobalt sleeves to the knobs of his bone and ash elbows. He says, you know I have this thing, right? This intuition. Some people have perfect vision, but not me. I wear these glasses for a reason. 40-60 eyesight. Instead, I have a knack for knowing when people are lying to me. A gift of compensation. Poor vision, but flawless interpersonal perception. Understand? I recall punching in this morning. The hour was 6 and I was making 6 an hour and making myself a sausage and egg bagel, a cup of coffee and dozing for 5 minutes on the countertop. I say, once when I was hungry, I created a new sandwich. I call it a stromboli sub. It was glorious. I'd been selling it on the side and ringing it under a club on the register. Listen, kid, loss prevention says. Who cares? Just let me do my job here. Have you or anybody else ever stolen anything from the store while you were employed here? No, I say. Why would I do that? He says, just so you know, we know everything. I'm just giving you the chance to come clean now. Clear your conscience. I shrug and say I'm sorry, but the stromboli sub is the only thing I can confess. Loss prevention says he knows. I'm telling him straight because he knows how to read people, and I am a good sort. Although he'd watch it, creating my own sandwiches. It disrupts the store inventory, internal shrinkage. Besides, I don't get paid to sit around and think of stupid things like putting stromboli on bread.
It's the poetry of Adam Macho. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts and Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30 a.m. for Prosody 90.5 FM.